No one wants another Joe. Let me be your friend. Even the strongest man needs friends.
I'm flattered. You're a man of finance and politics, Donald Casey. These are things I don't understand.
You understand guns? Finance is a gun. Politics is knowing when to pull the trigger.
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have on the show Richard C. Cook. He is a former NASA whistleblower, a U.S. Treasury analyst. I believe you worked at the White House as well, right? Back in the Carter days.
That's correct.
So we're going way back here. It's a lot of experience. Now you were involved in the Challenger. I think you released some information regarding the O-rings of the Challenger explosion and some of the politics behind that disaster.
That's correct.
And that was, yeah, I think it was, I saw the interview you did. I guess that February you leaked the story to the New York Times and we're off for the races, right?
Right, yes.
And that, refresh my memory, that prior to that, the public didn't know anything about the O-rings problem, right? That was like a...
That's correct.
Yeah.
No, the public knew nothing about it until that Sunday, February 11th, I believe, when the New York Times article came out with a whole big release of what I called the O-ring papers.
Uh-huh.
The topic had begun to be broached by the Orlando Sentinel over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just because they'd gotten some indications from some of their NASA sources that the what people suspected was that the solid rocket boosters had been the first to fail. And as they delved into it, the topic of the joints in the solid rocket boosters came up. But nobody really had a very good grasp outside of NASA of what that really meant. Till the O-ring papers came out in the New York Times on Sunday.
And as you said, this this part of the reason was the program was being taken over for military purposes, and there was as you described it, a gung-ho attitude about it. And so, I guess care wasn't taken, or diligence wasn't taken to, secure the safety of the crew, and they just want to get a mission out for whatever reason.
Well, they had known for years that there was an engineering flaw in the solid rocket boosters. And in fact, there was a program in place that had been approved to do a major re-engineering on the solid rocket boosters. In fact, there was supposed to be a test firing of the new configuration taking place in February of 1986, and in fact, I was scheduled to go out to the factory in Utah and witness that. But they made a decision to keep flying even as the redesign was being done, and they didn't have the willingness to stop and wait and fix it before it caused a disaster. And as I delved into it further, I reached the conclusion that the main reason was the pressure that was coming to fly missions for the Department of Defense in connection with President Reagan's Star Wars program, the so-called Strategic Defense Initiative. And because they weren't willing to stop for that, the thing just had to go on, and you know, the consequences were the disaster.
Yeah, so politics kind of took over, and then after Chris, then after the disaster, everyone just tried to avoid accountability and play CYA, and you have the cover up.
Yeah, there was a tremendous amount of finger pointing, but it was pretty clear after you know, people started to delve into it that the White House had been involved in the flawed launch decision because they were trying to get the shuttle up into orbit for the State of the Union address that Reagan was giving that night. And so some of us were able to trace it back to White House pressure in combination with the failure to fix the joint. So it was a whole bunch of factors that came into play, including the cold weather that night.
Yeah, I remember it was very cold that winter.
That caused the engineers out in Utah to recommend, well, didn't recommend, they demanded the flight be halted, but they were overridden and ignored. If you saw the, some of your listeners take a look at the four-part Netflix series on the Challenger disaster, that gives a pretty good accounting of the tremendous arguments that were going on the night before, when the engineers at Morton Thiokol were literally screaming to stop the launch, but they were overridden and ignored.
Okay, well, tonight I have you on to discuss your book, Our Country, Then and Now. It's it takes us on a 400-year history of America's economic and political, I guess you could say, controversies and disputes, largely revolving around financial questions, particularly money and banking, the nature of money and banking in the United States. This book, again, it's sweeping. It covers a lot of ground. I want to focus on some of the financial controversies, how it's affected the politics of the nation, and of course, the course of the nation.
Right.
We have from the get go. I mean, I'll let you take it from there. But from the get go, the country had was financial disputes or controversies. I mean, I'm thinking Alexander Hamilton, his idea of the national bank, and his disputes with Thomas Jefferson, and also the course, the assumption of the debt, which, if I recall, I think spawned the Whiskey Rebellion. So sort of that bond, and that was sort of a bond scheme too, of insiders, of aspiring oligarchs, if you will. The country immediately had an oligarchic class that was scheming to get rich off the backs of the people, and so immediately the country was founded sort of in bond fraud, in my opinion, and it's never really gotten out of that. But I'll let you take it from there.
Well, what people don't really understand very well is that the what is today the United States has a 400-year history.
Mm-hmm.
My first ancestor, and this is outlined in the book because I interweave mm-hmm. the historical narrative, my own family history, because my ancestors participated in many of the events of American history, including the series of wars that took place. And I also have Native American background through my French-Canadian grandfather. So I also cover in this book extensively the parallel history of the Native Americans. And I focus on the Flathead Reservation tribes from Montana, because I was actually born in Missoula, Montana, near the Flathead country. And so I have a very strong historical interest in the relations between the white Americans and the Native Americans. And I also interweave in the book the history of the African Americans. And of course, people don't realize that African Americans today have a much longer history than many of the latter-day white settlers who came over from Europe in the 19th or even the 20th century. So there's this whole very rich tapestry that goes back 400 years of how individual people, pioneers, people who fought in America's wars, Native Americans, African Americans, were all affected by the financial history of the United States. But as you say, the big event that took place after the Constitution was signed and George Washington became president, Alexander Hamilton was his Secretary of the Treasury, Thomas Jefferson was his Secretary of State, and the controversies over money and finance began immediately when Hamilton was able to get Congress to pass the legislation for the First Bank of the United States. Now, what this did was it created a funding mechanism for the United States government that was based on borrowing and debt. Hamilton had the idea that government debt and government borrowing should be used to build infrastructure that would support the economic development of the country. Now, that's not a bad idea. He called it internal improvements, and it mainly had to do with road and canal building back then. But what he did was he set up a mechanism where the stock in the bank was purchased by, as you say, the oligarchic class, by the people who already had money. And this was primarily, at that time, Europeans. The biggest stockholders in the First Bank of the United States were the Dutch bankers. And Holland at that time was the center of banking in the Western world, with England coming up pretty fast through the Bank of England. But the whole idea was that the creation of these early banks was done by institutions that were essentially owned, run, and existed for the profit of the already rich, of the people who already had the money. And even though Hamilton may have had a good idea to use government funding for infrastructure development, it was always polluted and corrupted by the profit motive on the part of the big bankers. Now, the biggest bank at that time in England was the Barings Bank. And the Rothschilds were going to come along a little bit later, but the bank that was the most prominent was the Barings Bank. And I cite an anecdote in there. You may recall reading the book. When Jefferson, as president, bought the Louisiana Territory
yes.
from Napoleon, he actually bought it from the Barings Bank.
Yeah,
because Napoleon had not trusting the new American Republic, sold his shares at a discount to the Barings Bank in London, and so when Jefferson bought Louisiana, he actually bought it from the Barings Bank.
So Napoleon, despite being, I'm not sure this is during the Peace of Amiens, 1803, 1804. Maybe technically they were at peace because this is during the Napoleonic period, the wars that Great Britain fought against Napoleonic France. At the same time, he's having British banks buy Louisiana. So he's behind the scenes, or just right. engaging in financial trading with Great Britain, even though the two countries are at war, which gives us sort of the transnational cosmopolitan nature of banking and finance, which transcends national boundaries. You know,
so exactly. That people speak of globalism.
Yeah.
Well, globalism goes way back.
Yeah.
As you can see.
Yeah, just at the same time that Barings would be involved in the financing of the National Bank. So you had British investment in the newly independent United States. Because the financiers up in New York, like Morris, were all invested with Great Britain. And again, right. the transnational nature of these things.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and this continued, and one of the features was that the bankers bought stock in the bank, and stock, of course, is an asset that can be bought and sold. And so when the first bank got going, and as you indicated, it took on the debt of the states that had fought during the revolution. And of course, the financiers were in there buying up the debt instruments that the soldiers had been paid in. And so this became a big scandal because they were getting rich off of the soldiers who had sold their shares in the war bonds at a great loss. But the financiers who owned the stock in the bank also saw the stock prices go up. So they made a big profit just by buying in. But the interesting thing was that they didn't actually buy in with anything of value, with what at that time was called specie or gold and silver. They put up a little bit of gold and silver to buy their bank shares, but most of it was actually promissory notes, that is, pieces of paper. And because the pieces of paper appreciated in price, they made profits for virtually no investment. And that was scandalous at the time. And that was one reason that when the charter for the first bank came up in 1811, when Madison was president, they were called Democratic Republicans at the time. Jefferson and his party refused to renew the charter for the first bank. And so the federal government got out of the banking business. And it was primarily state banks called wildcat banks did the bulk of the banking business for America all the way up to the Civil War. Now, we did have a short episode where the Second Bank of the United States came into play, but it did very little by way of financing of anything of value for the federal government. What it did mainly was sell government bonds to private investors. But again, you have a situation where the federal government, even in those early days, could not meet its expenses without going into debt. And so the idea of selling federal bonds, T-bonds, that today is such a catastrophe, also has a very long history going back to these early days. Now, there was a very short period during the presidency of Andrew Jackson when the federal government actually paid its debt and balanced its budget. Because Jackson did not want to have any more to do with the private bankers who were controlling government finance, he created a system of what they call the independent treasury, where the government actually put its revenues, and most of its revenues came from customs duties at the nation's ports, where they actually put that money into a vault. Well, at selected locations around the country. When I worked at the Treasury Department, they actually took me down to the basement and showed me this gigantic vault where they kept the money for the independent treasury. And so the government at that time, under Jackson and the Democrats, created a complete separation between the government and the banking system. And again, the banking system at that time were the small state and local banks that were called the wildcat banks.
And that system persisted up until the American Civil War, correct?
That's right. Actually, the independent treasuries was in existence all the way up to the creation of the Federal Reserve. But during the Civil War, some important things happened because the government was broke. The government, when the Civil War began, had no ability to put an army in the field because they just didn't have the money. So several things were done, and one of these was the government did borrow some money, but they borrowed it by and large by selling bonds to individual investors. A guy named Jay Cook, no relation to me, was the big financier who had agents going all throughout the country selling bonds to anybody who had little as $10 to invest. And so a lot of the money for the Civil War was raised through that avenue. But the big bucks that Lincoln needed were not available to him without going to the New York banks, tied in, of course, at that time with the British banks through the Rothschilds, and they wanted up to 40% interest on those on the loans that they were offering to the federal government. Lincoln refused to take those loans, and Congress passed the legislation for the greenbacks. And the greenbacks were the greatest innovation, in my opinion, in U.S. government financial history, because the government simply printed the money and paid it to soldiers, to vendors selling munitions and other equipment for the Civil War. And that money stayed into circulation all the way into the 20th century. Also during the Civil War, we had the beginnings of the modern tax system. So we had excise taxes. We had, which is just taxes on commodities being sold, kind of like a sales tax. And we had the earliest income taxes being put into place. So the Civil War brought a complete change in U.S. government finance, but they were able to keep control of public finance within the government, within the Treasury Department, due to the use of the greenbacks. Now, in 1863, they decided that they were going to need to get the government involved once again in the banking system, but they did not make any attempt at that time to create another central bank. So what they did was they passed the National Banking Act, and this allowed commercial banks to enter in a relationship with the government where they would actually buy treasury bonds again on credit, and they would use that as the basis of their capitalization. And with the treasury bonds and their own holdings of gold and silver, they used this as a lending base. And under the doctrine of fractional reserve lending, they were able to lend far more money than they held as assets. But the government still had a strong controlling interest in the national banks, which they lost when the Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913.
Yeah. Now, there is a lot of speculation regarding the intrigues around this, because one thing you have with the outbreak of the American Civil War, one of the controversies with the South was, of course, the tariff, the moral tariff. And previously that had been a cause for a secession crisis with South Carolina, tariff of abominations. And also the controversy over internal improvements, where the South didn't like the fact that it was being taxed to pay for internal improvements. The primary beneficiary they saw was the North, or other areas. So this kind of led one of divisions or reasons for the eventual secession crisis after Lincoln's election. Of course, Lincoln was the first Republican. Republicans were the successors to the Whigs and Henry Clay. And of course, Henry Clay had adopted the Hamiltonian division of internal improvements. So this is sort of an ideological division between the Democrats and the Southern Democrats and the new Republican Party at the time, which were the successors to the Whigs.
And right. Lincoln was actually a Whig.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In his career.
So that's sort of one of the many controversies of the time. But you mentioned, of course, Washington, or at least the Lincoln administration, going to New York, tied into the Rothschild banks being offered a loan of 40%.
Right.
Some people have speculated that the war itself was fomented by bankers wanting to divide the United States and make profit off the money that's borrowed. The old idea that all wars are bankers' wars, and right. but Lincoln undermined that by issuing the greenbacks, which are non-interest bearing.
Right. Yep.
Created a paper money and let the productivity of the northern economy back up the money. Labor, and so that's a very simple idea of paper money. You back it up with production, and for the most part, the North did that because production boomed during the war. In fact, it's one of the reasons why it was able to conquer the South. It was industrialized, overwhelm the South. But some people have speculated this might have factored into Lincoln's death in April 1865.
Well, there's this statement, and I quoted in my book. that was supposedly printed by the London Times. And of course, the London Times was tied in very heavily with the British banking system. And what it said was that if this new nation was allowed to issue its own money without having to borrow, but simply issued the money, no monarch in Europe would be safe. And so the speculation is, and I think it's probably true, was that the British and the Confederacy formed a conspiracy to assassinate Lincoln. And it's interesting that when John Wilkes Booth was killed after the assassination of Lincoln, he had in his pocket a credit slip from a major bank in Montreal. And it was Montreal that was the center of operations for both the Confederate Secret Service and the British Secret Service. And John Wilkes Booth had been to Montreal fairly recently before the assassination of Lincoln, where he apparently picked up the money he needed to hire his conspirators.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's fairly well established that this was kind of the whole scenario of the Lincoln assassination. And some people will argue that the same thing was done to Garfield and later to William McKinley.
Yeah, these lone nuts that pop up, right? These lone nuts.
I'm sorry?
These lone nuts that pop
oh,
up.
Oh, yeah, the lone nuts have a long history, don't they?
Yeah. Of course, the John Wilkes Booth, that's a proven conspiracy because we all know what Mary Surratt and the conspirators and that whole story. But it is, his ties into Montreal, which is tied into Confederate intelligence and also the British. And right. there are similar, there's an echo to that with the Kennedy assassination as well.
Oh, yeah.
A century later with Montreal, Permadex and Swiss Bank, and the various conspirators, perhaps, or a lot of these things involve a lot of players, if you will. Not one entity is involved in this and taking out or killing a monarch or a head of state. It's going to involve a conspiracy with many interests involved. And Lincoln, as well as Kennedy, had you could say even while taking a position on your view of their presidency and them as people, had had ruffled a lot of feathers in how they handled, how they executed their office or carried out their policies.
Very similar things happened, if I could jump in.
Sure.
In Russia at the same time, because Russia had a czar, his name was Alexander III, who simultaneously with Lincoln freeing the slaves in America, Alexander III freed the serfs in Russia,
mm-hmm.
and he and his government were also very resistant to a takeover of finance by the European bankers. And Alexander III, like Lincoln, was assassinated.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Did you ever find it interesting that Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, his wife was a descendant of John Wilkes Booth?
Oh. That's interesting. I didn't know that. I would have made that a footnote.
I think Claire Booth Luce was also a distant relative.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
I think. I might be wrong.
Booths were a prominent family.
Yeah. He was a very well-known actor.
Famous actors, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it is some of these interests, because when you look at some of the controversies of the Civil War, above and beyond the South's struggle for independence and the rights of secession and the legality of Lincoln's war, you have other intrigues, particularly how those conflicts are going to be exploited. And none of these conflicts are happening in a vacuum, of course. They're not occurring in a vacuum. And you have various existing powers, like the British Empire, which controlled pretty much the world at the time, has a stake in it, the outcome of that conflict. And you could see how in the 1860s, they could clearly see that America was a up and coming power and eventually would overtake Britain in the 20th century. But behind that, you have these banking families. It's one thing that you have the privatization of the country's monetary system and the control of oligarchs over these supposed sovereign nations. And usually, and what they use, they use the the system of banking and money to
Right.
more or less overwhelm or undermine the government, you know.
Right. Yeah, and what people really don't understand, and I really began to work with this material when I worked at the U.S. Treasury Department, and I actually developed training courses on the history of the U.S. government financial system. The whole system of fractional reserve banking is a relic of the Middle Ages, because some people are familiar with the idea that back in the old medieval towns, the local gold merchant would take in gold for safekeeping from merchants and give them paper notes that represented the value of their gold deposits. But because they could, they would issue these gold certificates in amounts far in excess of their actual holdings of gold. And the system that's developed out of that is called fractional reserve banking. And if you think about it, it's probably one of the most conniving, dishonest systems of finance that you can imagine, where a private entity that turned into a bank is able simply to issue as much paper as it's able to get away with. They're going to control the whole economic system of the country. And that's what our modern banking system is. It's the ability of private bankers to issue money far in excess of their actual reserve holdings, and they can do anything they want with it. So when you see these fantastic buyouts, for example, where a company goes and decides, well, we're going to buy Dunkin' Donuts, and we're going to buy the whole business for $6 billion, and we're going to fire half the people and put the rest on minimum wage, and really milk that business for all we can get out of it. Well, the money they're using to buy does not exist. That money comes from banks through fractional reserve lending. They're allowed to do this by the system that has been set up that took over our government a long time ago. It's crime. It's theft. It's organized crime. And yet this is the system that runs the Western world.
Yeah, there was a. I was watching a documentary on Prohibition a while back,
Right.
maybe 10 years ago, and they were talking about a convention that the families, the mafia families, had in Atlantic City, and they were trying to organize it, rationalize it to reduce the violence and increase the profits, and they discussed how would they organize it, and what they did was they said, "Well, we can mimic the way the Federal Reserve is operated."
Okay.
12 regional, you know, 12 regional banks,
Right.
and they decided to follow along the lines of the Federal Reserve system. I don't know if that was intentional. The narrator, the show I was watching, said, "Well, that's a fair, that's a fair comparison, I think." I don't know if it was intentional or not, but yeah, they just follow the way the Federal Reserve operates, the different
Yeah.
regions, and divide it up.
It's loan sharking by a different name.
Yeah.
But here's a point I want to make. And again, this is something that very few people realize, even people who study and read history and politics and all that. Throughout the whole of American history, at least, the history of our Constitutional Republic, there's been this battle going on between what you might call honest public finance, where the government actually spends only what it has. It's a very conservative kind of approach to finance, versus these banking cartels just going wild with creating huge amounts of money out of nothing. And this is where the banking trust came into play in the late 1800s. And the big names associated with the banking trust are J.P. Morgan and the Morgan banking interests, Jacob Schiff of Kuhn Loeb and Company. Schiff came from Germany, And it was actually Schiff who financed the Bolshevik Revolution through, again, money created out of nothing that he used to send agents to Russia to help overthrow the Russian government. And then coming in behind them were the Rockefeller interests, because John D. Rockefeller, of course, became the richest man alive through the Standard Oil cartel. But he was able to buy his way into the banking family by marrying off his son to Abby Aldrich, who was the daughter of the head of the Senate Banking Committee. And it was this group, of all the names I've just mentioned, that created the Federal Reserve System in 1913.
Mm-hmm.
What I would like to ask people to take away from this, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 was in fact an insurrection of private criminal interests against the Constitution of the United States. And they did it by buying off the politicians and putting Woodrow Wilson in the White House by arranging an election where President Howard Taft and former President Teddy Roosevelt divided the Republican vote in the 1912 election. Wilson, who'd been handpicked by the banking interests, became president. And one night in December, just before Christmas, they were able to railroad the Federal Reserve Act through Congress. And the Federal Reserve Act was actually written by the Rothschilds. And this was the system that was put into place and that we've had ever since. And as I say, this was an insurrection against constitutional government. The person who fought it most vigorously was Charles Lindbergh Sr. He was the father of the famous aviator Charles Lindbergh. But he fought it tooth and nail, but he was defeated in the congressional battle. And later, when he tried to run for governor of Wisconsin, the bankers hired thugs to go out and intimidate voters so he would be ridden out of government. And the whole thing was an insurrection. It was a revolution against the Constitution. And we're still living in that unconstitutional system now, today.
Yeah, Charles Lindbergh Sr. Is of course, is a very interesting figure and largely forgotten for reasons I think we understand. He's one that he called it the Money Trust. And he said, this act establishes the most gigantic trust on earth. When the president signs this act, the invisible government by the money powers proven to exist by the Money Trust investigation will be legalized. And he predicted that booms and busts will be scientifically planned.
Yep.
As a sort of pump and dump schemes. And of course, not too long after that, we saw that in of course, with the Great Depression.
Yeah. Now, another thing people don't realize is that this was part of a conspiracy to create a source of lending for England and France so they could fight World War One against Germany. Because England and France were just didn't have the resources. The World War would have ended within a year or two if England and France had to fight it on their own. But the Federal Reserve Bank was set up so that they could tap into the resources of the American banking system and use that to fight World War One, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, the pretty much America getting into the war was bailing out Wall Street, which had underwritten much of the Allied war effort, the right. Triple Entente war effort, which was by 1916 was failing. Because the summit failed.
None of this is speculation. I mean, all of this has been documented by the people who've been really interested in delving into the history. And a big name in this was Eustace Mullins,
who wrote
tremendous books about the Federal Reserve and the history of the Federal Reserve. And you can read the whole story there in his books.
Mm-hmm. And so you have a privatization of money creation.
Right.
And we simply don't know who actually owns the Federal Reserve System.
Well, legally, the Federal Reserve System, even though the chairman and the regional presidents are appointed by the U.S. government, the actual legal ownership is by the member banks. And the bank, the Federal Reserve Bank that makes monetary policy, is the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And that bank is literally legally owned by the banks of Wall Street. So we know who owns it.
Yeah, and that's why you see all these bailouts we saw back in 2008, right? Everyone covering each other, and you have like what was his name? Hank Greenberg, who was a member of the, I think he was a member of the board of the New York Fed, voting to bail out his insurance company.
Yeah. And my book has the whole history of that.
And then you
Did
also
you know?
you have the spectacle. I think it was Ben Bernanke, who was before the Senate Banking Committee, or maybe it was the House, I think it was the House Banking Committee. I think it was Congressman Sherman who had the temerity to ask him all these I think they were swapping out dollars for euros, and there was it was like 16 trillion in monetary and currency swaps.
Yeah.
16 to 24 trillion. They couldn't even give a number on it. It
Yeah.
was so enormous. And he asked him, "Well, who's getting the money? What's going on here? Can you tell us?" And Ben Bernanke refused to tell
Right.
the House Banking Committee, although theoretically, House Banking Committee has oversight over. But
Well,
apparently,
the Federal Reserve legislation could be abolished tomorrow. The Federal Reserve system could be wiped out tomorrow if Congress wanted to do it.
But if you look at the enormous debt that the federal government has today, obviously it's in hock to these creditors who loan the money to the federal government with money created out of thin air. Then they
That's
collect the interest on it.
the problem, isn't it? Yep.
And so that's
33.7 trillion is the federal government's debt today.
Now, you cite, of course, the Federal Reserve System, 1913, it's created, although technically at the time, for understanding, it was very, at least we were told that it's there to create an elastic money supply. Remember, we had the various panics, bank panics that were caused, liquidity crisis, if you will. And there was that Knickerbocker Trust failure in 1907. Some people say it was actually caused by J.P. Morgan, a whisper campaign, and then he came in as a savior. But this sort of became the justification for a Bank Reform Act. And
Right.
from what I understand, the original idea was to create an elastic money supply system to, I guess, to make ends meet, if you will, in a crisis, to provide the liquidity to avoid a bank panic.
Right.
And originally, it was designed to be money supplied, monetized by corporate paper, meaning there's something backing it up, restricting it. But along comes the First World War, then you're off the races because the federal government has to monetize debt to pay for the war, and then all those restrictions are cast aside. And there's a
Right.
crisis that comes along, so
Yeah.
immediately its mission expands, you know.
Well, you had banking panics from the early 1800s for 3 or 4 years. And then after the Federal Reserve was created, you had the recession, the post-war recession. Then you had the Great Depression. Then you had the recessions going into the 1960s. On and on it goes until you had Volcker's crash in 1979. Then you had the dot-com bubble crash, and then you had the great crisis of 2008, 2009. So anybody who thought that the Federal Reserve was going to stop banking panics and crashes really were out of their minds because they became be because the dollar had inflated so much. The banking crisis became worse and worse, and the value of the dollar, particularly after Lincoln removed or Nixon removed the gold peg in 1971, the dollar has inflated so much now that it's virtually worthless. So they just have to keep creating more and more and more government debt, which nobody's buying anymore. So yeah, we're headed for a catastrophe.
Yeah, I believe the as late as 2000, 71% of foreign cash reserves were held for US dollars. Now it's down to 55%. So there's a move away from the dollar,
Yeah.
and you don't have foreign creditors. The amount of foreign creditors buying U.S. debt has plummeted since 2013.
Yeah. And foreign creditors have largely been governments, particularly China, Korea, Japan. they were the ones who were floating the U.S. government and allowing the U.S. government to maintain its 800 military bases worldwide. But they're not doing that anymore.
Well, going to the, we have central banking, and that's just almost every country has a central bank. The Federal Reserve, of course, the Bank of England. You have, of course, the Bank of International Settlements, which I think was a product of the First World War settlement, but it persisted afterwards.
Right.
But the these things never go away. how has, say, for example, the Federal Reserve system? We can talk the Federal Reserve system itself, but nevertheless, up until 1971, there was some restriction to it because one thing was in the 1920s, you had an attempt to I guess reimpose a gold standard. I think it was the gold bullion standard or exchange standard. That was an attempt to prop up the English pound. But from what I understand, what happened was in the 1920s, the British government, I think at the time, the Chancellor of the Exchequer was Winston Churchill, who sought to maintain the British pound at par with the dollar pre-war, which is difficult to do because the British pound had been greatly inflated or devalued to pay for the war. But in
Right.
order to do that, the Benjamin, I think it was Benjamin Strong at the Bank of England, who was a good friend, I'm sorry, Benjamin Strong at the New York Fed was good friends with Montague Norman, the
Right.
central banker in Bank of England, and they worked out a deal where they would devalue the dollar, prop up the pound. Of course, this creates an asset bubble in the United States, and you had the Florida land boom, the stock market bubble, and all this lending is then circulated back into Germany to finance the German recovery in the late 20s. When
Right.
all this pops, the world collapses, you have the Great Depression, and this at the very time you have all these central banks that are there supposedly to supply liquidity to avoid a crisis, and they don't. Like the Federal Reserve just doesn't do anything. And I
Well,
think a third of the banks in the United States failure. There's a deflationary depression, and they don't do anything.
the problem was that you still had the gold standard, and the gold standard, the price of gold was controlled by the Rothschild banks of London. But because England in particular, and of course you get into f France did the same thing, borrowed so much money from the US banks, all of the gold literally had gone by steamship over to the United States. The United States was sitting on massive amounts of gold, which were constricting commerce on the continent of Europe. And so the way Eustace Bullins tells the story, Norman came over from England and they had a lunch with Strong and some of the other Americans. And over lunch, they decided, well, we got to move that gold back to Europe. And in order to do that, they had to tighten lending on the New York Stock Exchange, where all these stocks had been bought on margin, and the whole system crashed. So it was all done over lunch in moving gold back to Europe.
Now, it isn't all that predictable.
Yeah.
So
Well,
all the
it's.
suffering, all the
Yeah.
pain, the depression.
Yeah.
Oh well, we're just moving pieces on a board here. And
Right. And of course, that's what brought Hitler to power in Germany.
And then you
And
get the war, which then
right. So when as soon as Roosevelt was elected president, he took the U.S. off of the gold standard. And even though it was still there for international payments, it was not there any longer for domestic lending. And that's when Keynesian economics came into play. And the government decided, well, all we got to do is borrow our way out of this. And it worked to some extent. And we had Keynesian economics going all the way up until, the mid-20th century.
Oh yeah, I think arguably up until Reagan, right?
Yeah.
Supply side revolution.
Right.
So all that gold pours in the United States, but then you have the war, Second World War. And then that gold flows back in the United States, which becomes the basis for the Bretton Woods system, which
Right.
was designed by John Maynard Keynes and Harry Dexter White.
Yeah, and Harry Dexter White. I don't know, have you read Douglas Reed's book, The Controversy of Zion?
Parts of it, but I'm familiar with his back.
Yeah, that's a tremendous book. He was the
Yeah.
greatest he was the greatest English language journalist of the 20th century. And his book is over 500 pages long. And if you delve into it, you really learn some interesting things, such as, I mean, he makes a statement that Harry Dexter White actually worked for Stalin and that the Bretton Woods agreements were made up in Russia and installed in the United States. It's an interesting read.
Yes, because this creates the dollar as a de facto world reserve currency, and the
Exactly.
British pound is dethroned. I think it wasn't until Suez that it became obvious, right, that the British Empire was no longer had become
Yeah,
a poodle.
when Eisenhower forced the British to
Yeah.
back off from seizing the Suez Canal, Britain, France, and Israel, that pretty much was the signal that the era of the British lapdog had arrived.
Yes, and I think the signal came in the form of he told the banks to sell British pound sterling. So
Exactly.
the fragility of the British economy at
Yeah.
that point.
Yeah.
So you have Bretton Woods from roughly 1944 to 1971,
Right.
and oddly enough, the official price of gold is still $35 an ounce, even though you have an explosion in dollars because of the exorbitant privilege that the
Right.
U.S. enjoyed in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Of course, we pay for
Yeah.
it with all the inflation in the 70s, but this is a result of all the spending in the seven and the six in the 60s with the Vietnam War and the Great Society, correct?
Right. Yes, that's what triggered the Nixon's action was that France told the U.S., "Hey, I want my gold because I've got all your dollars, so give me my gold." And Nixon said, "Well, we better not do that." And so that's when the petrodollar came in as the reserve currency through an agreement between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia that our late great friend Henry Kissinger
That's right.
came up with. And that's been pretty much the system since then. You keep reading if on these little internet ads you get to invest in gold, that Saudi Arabia is about to pull the plug on this system. And if they pull their money out of the banking system, then we're in real trouble.
So the basis for it really isn't like, although economics plays a part in it, basically it is a sort of a diplomatic military question.
Yes, exactly.
At the same time, you have you talk about in the book, and again, you got to read the book because we can't really give do it justice in a 60 to 90 minute interview.
Right.
Of course, after the Second World War, you have the growth of intelligence agencies in the United States, the formalization of the intelligence community, if you will, with the National Security Act and creation of the Central Intelligence Agency, which was an outgrowth of wartime intelligence agencies. I think it was OSS and Central Intelligence Group. Truman didn't like it at first, but then again, we know presidents really don't make decisions. They're
Right.
told what to do, and he relents, and the CIA is created. And you have all these operations, particularly Office of Strategic Services in Asia, and this is goes back to the 30s, and the Flying Tigers and Claire Chennault, and the use of the sale of opium to pay for off-the-books operations. In the 30s, this persists. I
Right.
believe in the Japanese, and even during the war, I guess it goes to the transnational nature of these relationships with the drug trade. Your Japanese generals trading with Chinese communists during the war just to sell drugs. But this persists. Of course, this factors into Vietnam, and one of the reasons why the U.S. nudged the French out in 1954 was to take over the opium trade.
Right.
It was flowing, and we do one thing that you had in the Cold War was, and whether it's Central America, or Asia, the Golden Triangle, or the Golden Crescent later in Afghanistan, is whenever you have a national security CIA intelligence operation, you have a brisk drug trade.
Yes, as you did in Afghanistan. In fact, there's a writer that I've used as a resource. His name is Guido Preparata.
Oh, I interviewed him, yes.
You've talked to him, you
A
know him,
while back. Yeah, I interviewed about his book about Hitler. Yeah.
I used his book on Hitler as one of my main
Conjuring Hitler, I think is the name of the book.
Conjuring Hitler
Yeah.
for my account of the period between World War I and World War II. And he says outright that the reason the U.S. went into Afghanistan was to capitalize the failing financial system by marketing heroin out of Afghanistan. So, yeah.
Yeah, the UN actually made that observation as well in a report in the during the crash of 2008. One thing that kept the banking system afloat was the constant flow of drug money into the banking system, laundering it. There is a, and what this also the effect, this isn't just something that you can say it boosts the US economy, but only problem is it also boosts the number of addicts in society and the drug abuse in society as well, and the societal rot. Think of the opium wars in China, correct? There is are you familiar with Catherine Austin Fitz? And she her popsicle index.
That I'm not familiar with.
Well, what she talks about, you can you as the growth of the I think of the Dow Jones, it basically stock values go up as the quality of life drops in the United States.
Well, that's certainly an interesting
And why
point.
that is because Wall Street is involved in massive laundering of drug money, and the drug money, every dollar in drug money that's being laundered, represents drugs that's flowing into the veins or going up the noses or people smoking it, and that has a obviously an effect on ultimately the economy because you're destroying the cap the most important capital stock of a country is its people,
Well,
and.
I say in my book that the United States currently is engaged in a genocide campaign against its own population. This is part of it. There's certainly a lot of economic aspects, such as the impossibility of ordinary people to buy a home. This is the big thing that Robert Kennedy Jr. is pushing in his campaign. But But it all goes back to what we were saying earlier. I date it to the insurrection of 1913 when the international bankers took over the US government and the US Constitution by passing the Federal Reserve Act. And since that time, our country has been run by organized crime.
Yeah, I think in 1905, the vast majority of business expansion was financed through profits and equity. And that was a crisis for the banking system because the banking system relies on users' debt.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's how the money trust was able to take over the steel trust, the steel industry, the oil industry, all the other industries gradually became creatures of the banking system. And it's the same today. I mean, I knew a guy who, he was the president of a company. It was one of the major lawnmower companies. And he was right up there. He had a big workforce, factories. He said he made no decisions. Wall Street made all the decisions. They just told him what to do. And that's the way it is. That's organized crime. And our whole economy is built on that. You look at who owns companies. I mentioned Dunkin' Donuts. They're owned by some, they may be owned by China actually by this time, but they're all owned by some financial holding company run out of Wall Street. And do you know who owns Lockheed Martin, the biggest US defense firm? Well, Lockheed Martin is owned by Vanguard, BlackRock, and State Street, which is a bank in Boston that never could have gotten into this business if it hadn't had to repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999 under Clinton, who was the best friend of the banking cartels that we ever had. But all these things are owned by the big banks, the big holding companies, and they're all run on the basis of illicit money coming in from, as you mentioned, the drug industry, or just created out of thin air.
Well, we saw that with COVID, right? I believe it was the summer of 2019 when they decided to call what they say go direct, and that was to have the banks take over the fiscal policies of the federal of governments, and that's basically what they would just simply monetize everything,
Well,
and
yeah. And of course that was done long ago for the federal government. When I worked for Treasury, you never said anything about the Fed. It was all done in whispers. You never criticized the Fed or because they were the fiscal agent of the government, and they had all the money. Literally, every night we would put all the money in the federal government's accounts into the Fed because they could use that in the banking system as a reserve for more fractional reserve lending. And the amount of money that's used this kind of money created out of thin air that goes into derivatives is something that is just absolutely staggering.
And this
And
is a good example of where they're taking this money. They're betting on it. It's not theirs. Then they use the gains to buy up real assets, like Dunkin' Donuts or a lawnmower company
exactly. And look at George Soros.
Yes.
Where did he get his fortunes? He got it by speculating on against the English pound, by betting against the English pound in currency swaps. And now the guy runs, half the police departments in the U.S. It's
Yeah,
crazy.
he leverages that money for political control. That's
Oh,
another thing is you have
it's
like BlackRock, Larry Fink openly talks about ESG, environmental social governance. And
right.
now he's assuming that these corporations, which have the benefit of corporate charters and limited
Right.
liability, all types of exemptions from taxation, and at the same time, they're leveraging their money to, in effect, change society outside the legislative
And he's
process.
buying Ukraine.
Yeah.
He's buying Ukraine. He and the Pritzker family.
And then he's invested in
He's buying
companies
Ukraine.
that are pouring arms into Ukraine. So he's making money off the war, then planning for the post-war environment.
Right. Now, it's very interesting that one of the things that Russia has done that has made Putin so much of an enemy to the West is he's gradually put a stop to all of this. All these oligarchic shenanigans, as it were, and he's brought the central banking system of Russia into the government and used it to build Russian the Russian manufacturing economy and to raise the standard of living for the Russian people. And so this is why they want to get rid of Putin. And the same with China. China has a central bank that works for the government. They've got private banking as well as an auxiliary, but the key controlling interests, both in Russia and China, are held by the central bank that is literally a government agency.
Yeah, apparently they've made the oligarchs subservient or subordinate to the state, whereas in the West, the states have become subordinate to the oligarchs.
And that's what Putin did when he became president. He took the oligarchs and said, either you work with us, you pay taxes, or you're out. And some of them left. Some of them went to live in their mansions in London or wherever, Israel. But yeah, he cracked down on that whole system. And that's why Russia is such a powerhouse today.
I want, something. And now for like BlackRock, you look at how they get so many assets. In some cases, just handed to them. You remember during the early stages of the COVID, of the so-called pandemic. They were put in position to refloat the U.S. economy. The BlackRock was given, for, I think, $4 or $5 trillion to pump up the market, and they turned that around. And now, if you look at who's buying up all, they're buying up huge swaths of residential homes. So these hedge funds or these asset management companies are now buying up homes, competing with individual homeowners, and running up the cost of homes and pricing out families. So you're going to turn into a sort of a renter economy where no one owns anything,
Well,
everyone rents
yeah,
everything.
that's been the bankers have been trying to do that for a long time. There was back in even in the late 1800s, and I wrote about this in my earlier monetary book. The American Banking Association actually was sending letters around to its members saying that we're going to turn American farmers into European peasants. So we want you to go out there and buy all the land you can. Of course, the farmers fought that. But yeah, that's been the objective of the bankers forever.
That's the thing with debt is if you have if you encourage borrowing to expand productivity, in this case the farms, like they did, say during World War One, and all of a sudden the war ends, and all of a sudden U.S. agriculture goods aren't as in demand, but the debt's still there. Then you have a deflationary crash. They still own the money, but there's been a deflationary period, and they use that deflationary period to buy up the farms. Yeah, and they can pump and dump it, you know.
That's called a business cycle. But
Yeah.
another thing people don't understand is how inflation results from debt, because like with the federal government. The federal government loves inflation because it allows tax revenues to increase kind of by formula that allows them more leverage in paying down their debt. I got into an argument not too long ago with the mayor of the town I live in because we were fighting the appraisal on our house because the county has taken all these inflated housing values and jumped on everybody to raise their appraisals and their taxes. And I fought this, and I beat him back a little bit, but I told the mayor of our town, "You guys love inflation because it dries up your revenues and you can pay yourselves more and you can come up with all these neat projects." So now they're building this new pavilion with solar paneling on the roof and blah, 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 just because of the inflation in housing values. This is just another aspect of the criminality of the whole system. And that's one reason the dollar has become so worthless, is because everybody is raising prices in order to escape debt. And there's no way out of that.
So you need it, ultimately you need something what the Bible would call a jubilee.
Exactly. And that's where, Michael Hudson, he's pretty famous for his history lessons on the old time debt jubilees that the ancient governments used to put into place. And I know Michael, I shared a podium with him once at a basic income guarantee conference, and he's really got it that whole system nailed down pretty good. If there's no way to reduce, escape, or pay down debt, you're just going to have the whole system explode in every kind of maneuver, inflation, criminality that you can think of, because it's totally destructive to any ordinary system of economics or way of life of any people. Debt will destroy a country, and it's
So
just not as today.
the traditional Catholic prohibition or biblical prohibition on usury is something that we should reconsider then.
Absolutely. I calculated once, or maybe somebody else did, and I just picked up on it. I think it was Steve Zarlinga, who was the head of the American Monetary Institute. Are you familiar with his work?
No, I am not.
Yeah, Zarlinga was a brilliant economist who I worked with, and actually we produced, working with Dennis Kucinich. Kucinich actually introduced legislation in 2011 to abolish the Federal Reserve and create a greenback style monetary system for the US. And it would involve the federal government, the Treasury Department, lending money to banks for them to lend in turn to the public. But we figured that the bank should be able to lend money at an interest rate of 1%. That would be completely adequate to pay all their expenses, a reasonable profit, and to support the financial needs of the American economy. Now, I mean, think about that. 1% should pay for everything. Instead, what do we have? Well, we have 5% today, but compounded, 5% itself is a ruinous interest rate. That
Yeah,
would be
you can
totally
never pay
false.
it off.
Never pay it off.
And well, one thing is what central banks do pay for, they pay for a whole lot of war and human suffering.
Oh, yeah.
And one thing is with these plans to sort of whether it's greenbacks, state banking or national banking interests of the people, you have to stop the wars. And the problem is the bankers are all heavily invested in all these wars for various reasons, whether it's, financing Israel's slaughter in Palestine, or what's going on in Ukraine, with the that's I guess you could say it's a proxy war against Russia on her
Yeah, the
border.
profit, the banking profit motive is behind all of it. All of it. And has been. Again, we go back to World War One.
Well, yeah, it's the control of energy. That's why they blew the pipeline up. Jeez, at this point, it's pretty obvious. They don't want Russia trading with Germany because they want Germany trapped in the NATO system.
Well, that opens a whole new topic, which is the Morgenthau Plan. I'm not familiar with that, but in fact, Hudson himself says that the Ukraine war is really a war against Germany.
Yeah, the German government is complicit in that.
Absolutely, yeah. I
Yeah.
mean, they're assets of MI6 and the CIA, the German political leaders.
Yeah, they I mean, I might be, I don't want to, they haven't had a independent government since 1945. It's just the way it is. Because they don't have a functional constitution. They're still occupied.
They were still
Yeah.
an occupied nation.
You remember that reporter, was an Uder Okote, I forget to pronounce his last name. He died of a heart attack right after. But he worked for what German newspaper it was. He admitted that he was paid by the CIA just to write news reports. He was told what to write, and then I think a year later he had a heart attack at the ripe old age of like 52 or something.
I remember that.
But that's just that's just a brief, I guess you could say, anecdotal illustration of just how these countries are controlled. And from time to time, governments have tried to break out of it. You could argue Gaddafi was trying to break out of the dollar system. He had a gold backed currency, and also a whole lot of oil and valuable aquifers that were stolen. And you've had other. There was, of course, de Gaulle in the '60s. He found himself being overthrown when he challenged the dollar. There, who was that? There's a banker, German banker, who had entertained the idea of debt forgiveness for the third world. And he's kidnapped, I think, by some communist group. This is probably a Gladio operation. He turns up dead. So that there's a there's a long trail of bodies of people who've proposed breaking out of this system.
That's right.
I mean, so it's just you didn't want to break out of that control system, which is control of energy, money, finance. And you mentioned how that was kind of taken over in the early part of the 20th century, turned into this sort of a monopoly thing.
Yeah, and you have to wonder if this is going to come to a head now with the development of the BRICS system, and the way that seems to be headed is a major conflict between the BRICS system and the Western control.
Well, it's interesting because China, development of China was largely an oligarch plan, a Rockefeller plan. Has it turned out to bite them?
They were going to co-opt China. That was the whole Nixon opening to China plan,
That
was
was
to
Kissinger, you're
co-opt.
right. Kissinger's
So,
thing.
with Kissinger. But Kissinger was a Rockefeller asset. So the whole thing was a Rockefeller plan. And so it kind of has started to backfire, hadn't
Yeah,
it?
it's you see this in history, and there's always a war. A similar thing happened with Japan in the early 20th century, where Japan was sort of a
That's
cat's
right.
paw for Anglo-American.
Well, the reason that Japan defeated Russia in the Russo-Japanese War was because of British backing. And it was Britain that made Japan what it was as a counter to Russia. Japan got the idea in their heads that, well, this works pretty well. Maybe we'll be a nation.
Yeah, basically it was the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere was sort of an Asian Monroe Doctrine, if you will. Yeah. And I think there was one Japanese diplomat who wryly remarked in 1941, when the Roosevelt administration was backing them into war, So just when we learned to play poker, they changed the game to bridge.
But
You know.
people need to realize that this system, this cannot continue. The parasite kills the host, and the parasite is killing the host, and the host is the people of the nation, and the people of the Western nations. And as we were saying, the governments end up in a campaign of genocide against their own people.
Yeah, we see that with macroeconomic policy. We see it with the drug trade, human trafficking, the weaponized migration is a part of that. The destruction of Ireland as an Irish state, and they think they can just flow people in and the great replacement controversy and all that. It's all part of it.
Our southern border
Yes.
is part of it, and they've been doing this for a long time. This was how Franklin Roosevelt stayed in power, was by unlimited illegal immigration. But it can't go on. The world is being divided into two bitterly opposed armed camps, and they're not backing down on either side. The West is becoming more and more desperate, and the
Well,
East
is
becoming
I mean,
more and
isn't
more determined.
I see figures like Putin as being far more reasonable than our leadership.
Yeah.
I mean, his remarks are far more lucid and cogent than anything that comes out of the mouth of a Western so-called statesman.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
Yeah. Well,
look at our leadership, Joe Biden.
you know what the hierarchy is now for the Democrats. The latest poll, if Biden goes, it's number one, Kamala Harris, number two, Hillary Clinton, number three is Bernie Sanders, but they'll never let him in the door. Number four is Gavin Newsom, and number five is Buttigieg. That's what they have to offer. No nation can survive that.
No.
So yeah,
And
we're heading for we're
maybe it's
heading for
comforting to know that our politicians don't make any decisions. Put it that way.
well, the puppet politician is part of the plan and has been for a long, long time.
Yeah, I mean, when was the last president to act like a president? Do you think it was John F. Kennedy?
Yeah, Kennedy was.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a tremendous book about Kennedy written by a professor named Donald Gibson, University of Pittsburgh. He's written a couple books, one on the Kennedy assassination cover-up, and then another one on Kennedy called Battling Wall Street. And that gives more insight into Kennedy's actual economic program than anything that has ever been written.
What
Kennedy believed.
motivated? What do you think motivated that? His father was a player, but was it his Catholicism, you think?
Partly, but he was also a New Dealer. Kennedy was brilliant, and he had the whole New Deal philosophy intact, and knew what to do as far as finance was concerned. He understood the financial system, and one of the key elements of his program was lower interest rates. And that's always a key, lower interest rates. Because you break up the usury cartel, and that's probably why the Rockefellers, I think it's pretty certain the Rockefellers had a part in taking him out, but he was launching a major frontal attack on the banking system. Plus, he was going to take Latin America away from the Rockefellers through the Alliance for Progress.
That's right. That was Nelson Rockefeller's baby, wasn't it?
Nelson Rockefeller owned Latin America.
Yeah,
Yeah.
he'd been busy during even during World War II. I think he was in charge of that.
He was in charge of that. In
Yeah,
fact,
yeah.
people talk about OSS as the predecessors of the CIA. Well, Nelson Rockefeller was running his own OSS in Latin America. And that's where the whole Latin American military system came from. It was from their cooperation with Rockefeller in keeping his banking system going down there. So yeah,
Yeah,
but
that's why you have like coups in Guatemala to
yeah.
bail out United Fruit. And of course, United
Right.
Fruit, the Dulles brothers, I think, are on the board of United Fruit. So you have all that collusion,
Yeah.
you know, with these CIA doing the same thing with Mossadegh and Iran the year before,
Yeah.
53, a similar type of relationship, or just doing the bidding of the Seven Sisters and British Petroleum.
So anyway, these are among the topics I write about in my book. I hope people will read it and
Yeah, it's again a
out of
400
it.
year history. It's sweeping. You cover a lot of this stuff. Of course, to understand a lot of these things, a lot of these intrigues, you have to have a I mean, you obviously the book you can't cover it all, so you have to. I encourage other people to do further research in these things, and that the some of the assertions or some of the things you write about in the book have a lot of there's a lot of evidence, let's just say.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I tried to minimize the philosophizing and maximize the detail. But let me just say that I made a decision, and of course part of it was based on my own experience and background. I was at the U.S. Treasury for over 20 years. I learned a lot, but I decided in this book to focus on the institution of fractional reserve banking. And to try to show how that was behind a lot of the events that you just kind of see on the surface. But if you delve into them and find out about the banking system and fractional reserve banking, and particularly the insurrection of 1913, that unlocks a lot of doors for people.
And the fact that that insurrection was sort of a transnational coup,
Yes,
this
it was.
conspiracy of all these banks, the Wahlbergs, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, and these families, Nelson Aldrich, that was his bill. I think they made it a Democratic bill because people were suspicious of it, but it was the same bill. And of
Right.
course, Nelson Aldrich marries into the Rockefeller family, and
Right.
Nelson, and of course, Nelson Rockefeller is named after his, Nelson Aldrich.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a conspiracy. It was a,
Yeah.
and they knew it was a conspiracy, and they called it a conspiracy. And we haven't even delved into how it tied in with Zionism, because that was part of the conspiracy too.
Well, that's a whole nother can of worms, especially these days.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it really is.
It's we're being treated to a lot of that now. Propaganda and hysteria, it's what you'd expect. But yeah, so I do strongly recommend the book. You can get it at Amazon, right?
Can we give the title?
Sure, good. It's good. I'll let you t say it.
Our Country Then and Now. And it has a cover photo. The then is the Colonial Capitol building in Williamsburg, Virginia. That's where I went to school there. I actually lived 10 minutes from that place. It's where the Resolution for American Independence was first introduced, where the Convention of Virginia instructed their delegates in Philadelphia, including Jefferson, to introduce the resolution for the American independence. So that's the top photo. And the bottom photo is the U.S. Capitol building during the second Trump impeachment with barbed wire and armed guards going around it. Kind of
Yes.
symbolize the divisions that have beset our nation. But it's Our Country Then and Now. You can go to Clarity Press and find it. And I'm pretty happy with the publisher there. Scott Ritter's one of their writers and other people you've heard of. Clarity Press. You can order the book now off of Clarity Press, or you can pre-order it on Amazon or Barnes and Noble and other places. It's supposed to become available in January.
Excellent. Well, I
You can
want to
get it
thank you.
now. You can get it now, PDF or hard copy off of the Clarity Press website.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure, Tim.
It was a pleasure talking to you. You
Yeah.
have very wide swath of knowledge on these things. It was good to kind of tap your brain, get your thoughts on this. I'll post this soon. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, I'll send it in the contacts.
And I will wish you Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Tim. You too. Have a good one.
Good night, then.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye.